This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
In the years before I made Aliyah, so for about 10 or 12 years, I would take 2 weeks during the summer, sometime after Tisha B'Av and before the new school year began, and I would travel to a place where nobody could find me. Took a backpack and a sleeping bag and a tent and no cell phone, and I would just go out somewhere very, very far away. It was a place to just get away from everything and hike and just relax. And on Shabbat, I would always find myself a cabin someplace. So I wasn't living in a tent. And what do you do in a cabin all Shabbat when there's nothing else you can do? I took out my Chumash and I would read through all of Sefer Devarim from beginning to end, 5 or 6 times over the course of Shabbat. And I did that every year for 10 or 12 years, which means over the course of that time, I must have read Sefer Devarim somewhere in the range of 50 to 60 times. And I feel confident saying here that I still don't get it. Sefer Devarim for me is the most difficult and the most challenging of all the Sfarim and Chumash. Vayikra is a piece of cake compared to Sefer Devarim. And we could spend a long time talking about why I find it so difficult. But all you have to do is, for a second, just go to its Hebrew name or its Latin name. Okay, the Hebrew name for Sefer Devarim is Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah means that it's a repeat. And in fact, many of the classical commentaries, when they talk about Sefer Devarim, they struggle to figure out why there's so much repetition between Sefer Devarim and the rest of the Chumash. Deuteronomy means the second set of law codes. So the Latin name and the traditional Hebrew name both reflect the fact that there's a tremendous amount of repetition from Sefer Devarim to the previous Chumashim. The great challenge, and there are two great challenges. One is understanding the whole structure of the Sefer and how the different pieces fit together. The other challenge in Sefer Devarim is the fact that it disagrees. There are multiple contradictions between Sefer Devarim and other places in the Chumash. And a tremendous amount of ink has been spilled upon this, starting with Chazal. And you find tremendous amount of discussion within the rabbinic literature, going all the way up until the modern times. Very recently, Micha Goodman wrote a fascinating book on Sefer Devarim, where he has a thesis that he tries to put forth, which is a really, really interesting book. Those of you who can handle the Hebrew, it hasn't been translated into English yet. I really recommend it. It's a great piece of work. But that being said, it presents many, many riddles, and one of my ultimate dreams in life is to be able to understand Sefer Devarim. What I'd like to share with you today is one basic insight from Sefer Devarim that I do have, and one that illuminates, I think, or I hope, a large piece of what its ultimate goal is. And I'm going to go straight to the first chapter of Sefer Devarim. You mentioned that there are multiple stories that are told in the book of Devarim that are repeated, stories and laws that are basically repeats of things that happened earlier or told to us earlier in the Chumash. And they're all told to us in ways that are different from the way they're told to us earlier in Chumash. The classical Parshanim go out of the way to try to figure out how to resolve those differences. Upon close inspection, I find it nearly impossible to resolve them. And today we're going to look at two examples and come up with some surprising conclusions. There are two stories that are told in the very beginning. The first chapter of Sefer Devarim tells us two stories. One is a story about judges, and the second is a story about spies. And we know both of those stories. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to start with the story of the spies, because it's the most well-known, and the contradictions are are talked about more frequently than any of the other contradictions in the stories, introduced to us primarily by Rashi, and then later on Ramban has his own take on this. So the text of the story of the spies appears in the Hebrew pages on page 4 and 5, and in your English on pages 6 and 7. And what I've done is I've lined up the two sources side by side. So on one side you have the entire story written out, broken down into basically five sections, as it's told in the book of Devarim. And then next to that, the parallel text as it appears in Sefer Bamidbar Sinai, the book of Numbers. And I did the same thing in both the Hebrew and the English, so that it's readily accessible to anybody. And whoever wants to be working in the Hebrew, you can work in the Hebrew. Those of you who want to be working in the English, work in the English. And what we'll do is, we'll take about 15 minutes now, and with whoever is sitting next to you, just read the two stories, and you might just want to read through the one whole text and then read through the whole other text, or you might want to read one side and then look at its parallel on the other side and see if you can identify some of the differences. And once we find out what the differences are, then we'll have something really meaningful to talk about. So, everybody got that? And if you're sitting by yourself, so go find somebody else to sit next to. And we have the two sources. And I, by the way, I'm going to call one of them the original source. The one from Bamidbar Sinai, I'm going to call the original source because that's where God is telling the story. And the other one I'm going to call Moshe's source, because one of the main features of Sefer Devarim is that it's the words of Moshe. Eileh ha-dvarim asher diber Moshe. Much of Sefer Devarim is told to us in the first person. It's Moshe describing the events to Bnei Yisrael and retelling them. Okay, so those are the two versions that we have, and I'd love to hear what you have to say. Okay, so let's start. It wasn't worth writing it again. Did you find anything interesting and like any differences between the two accounts? Exactly the same. Who wants to start by sharing an insight that they found? Sure.
One, people said send the spies, and the Midbar God says send them.
Right. In Moshe's version, it's the people's idea to send the spies. And in the original version, in Bamidbar, it's God's idea to send them. Okay, that's pretty big. All right, what else? Right. In the original version, Moshe is the only active thing that Moshe does in that story is he formulates the questions, he formulates the instructions. But in that's completely missing in the Devarim story. Okay? Yes. Okay, interesting. It's called a different name. It turns out Eretz Kanaan is the generic name for the larger area. There are the mountain area was called the land of the Emori, but it's an interesting observation. Yes. Interesting. Anything else? Sure. Yeah, those are two huge things. You read through the original version in Sefer Bamidbar Sinai, the only thing that Moshe does actively is give instructions. And then you don't hear his voice again until after God issues a decree. When the guys come back and deliver their reports, we don't hear a word from Moshe. The only thing that we see, we observe Moshe and Aaron falling on their faces, God coming to rescue them. Like the cloud comes, like Big Brother comes to save them from the schoolyard brawl. And then Moshe turns to God. He doesn't talk to the people at all. He turns to God to save them. Whereas in the story that Moshe tells, it's very different. Moshe presents himself as the great defender of Eretz Yisrael. or of the promised land. Forget Eretz Yisrael, as the great defender of the promised land, which is extraordinary, and that's huge. And the other piece is that Moshe blames them. He says, "What you did back there with that whole story of the spies—that's the reason I'm not going into the land." Now, that was a pretty devastating decree that Moshe didn't go into the land. He had been planning on it his entire life. And then, boom, right? In the 40th year, he hits the rock and God tells him you're not going in. But what Moshe tells them is that that had been decreed 39 years earlier because of this whole business. That's strange. Yeah. Well, right. And particularly with the juxtaposition of what the Torah says about Moshe, Vayish Moshe Anav Ma'od, incredibly modest. And here we have this incredibly modest man who's taking credit for things that he never did. Oh. Yeah, that's quite puzzling. The story, the way it's originally told to us, Moshe, when the spies or scouts, or whatever you call them, they come back and they deliver a report that's a negative report. They say the land is, basically it's like saying, the land is too is really great, but we can't afford to go there. We're not strong enough. We just can't do it. So we better turn around. And Moshe omits that entire piece. He says they came back with a great report. So he takes credit for a lot of stuff, and he cleanses those 12 guys, he absolves them of any responsibility, when the Torah clearly presented us with something completely different. Anything else that you found? If we're not bothered enough by... Yeah. That's an amazing question, because if we're talking about towards the end of the 40th year, we're talking this speech... takes place 5 weeks before his death. So there is nobody around from that original generation except those who are really young at the time. So you're saying because they're all dead, he can get away with it. Wow. Right. Yes, he is talking to them as if they were. And here's a really interesting thing. He thinks he can get away with it. And I guess he didn't anticipate that his words would get written down in the Torah right next to, right? That we'd be able to do this and catch him, right? And so it almost sounds like God says, yeah, you're going to try to get away with that. The crazy part, by the way, is that in the next Perek, which we're not going to get to, in Perek Beit, he does the same thing. He completely retells a story, but it's about a story that happened 3 months earlier. So here you can say maybe he thought about it, and he can get away with it, you know, that none of them remember so long ago. But when he's talking to generation, that it just happened to them, right? And he does the same kind of thing. So we have that. Let's keep that in mind. Okay, with any other observations you wanted to share over here? Right. Okay, so there are a lot of little differences, and maybe those little differences we could forgive, but the big ones are really troubling. Moshe repaints this entire story, and what bothers us is not just that he tells it differently, but he tells it differently in ways that seem to highlight himself as the hero. He's the hero of the story, the way he tells it. And when you take a look at the original story, he is not the hero at all. He's the victim, or he's the anti-hero. He's the one who couldn't say a word. Kalev is actually the hero of the original story. Moshe mentions Kalev over here, but and Miss Yoshua, all these pieces are deeply, deeply troubling. Okay, so what we're going to do is not going to answer it. We're gonna hold off. What I'd like to do is I'd like to look at a second story in the same chapter. And I add, we're going to see something just as troubling, if not even more so. And I always ask myself the question, why were these the two stories that Moshe chose to open with? If he's retelling the history of the Jewish people from the time they left Egypt, so, you know, before these stories happened, you have the story of Matan Torah, which he'll tell later. We have the story of Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, which he'll tell later. There are a whole bunch of other things which he tells later, and yet he chooses to open with these two stories. So the second story we looked at individually, that was the story of the spies. The first one is the story of the judges. It's often overlooked because it's short and people don't pay attention to the differences. That's on the opening two pages in the Hebrew and on pages 3 and 4 in the English. Okay, and maybe we'll do a little bit of this together. These texts are actually, in the Hebrew it's on page 1 and in the English on pages 2 and 3. I chose to do this together rather than in a chavruta because they're a lot more complex. If you take a look at the sources, so Moshe tells a story, right? That his story is clearly told to us in Devarim, the first chapter. But the story that he tells is a composite one. There's not a single parallel source. There are multiple parallel sources. I brought only 3. I believe there are probably at least 2 more that he wove into this very creative story that he's telling. And this is actually the very first thing he says. So let's take a look at this together. I noticed that most of you are working in the English. But what I'll do is I'm going to read in the Hebrew. You can follow along in the English. I'll do a very loose running translation as we go along. Okay? So in the Hebrew, Dvarim Perek Aleph, Pasuk Vav, Pasuk 6, Hashem Elokeinu Diber Eleinu B'Chorev Lemor, God spoke to us at Chorev, saying, Rav Lachem Shevet Bahar Hazeh. You sat here long enough. Pnu Usu Lachem. Turn and start traveling. Uva'u Har HaEmori Vel Kol Shechinav. And I want you to go to the mountain of the Amori, and all of its neighbors, which is again another way of saying the Canaanite, the land of Canaan, Ba'arava in the Arava Valley, Bahar, the mountains, the central mountain range, Bashfela, the lowlands when you go past the mountain range, Uva Negev, the mountainous region in the south, Uva Chof Hayam on the coast. These are basically the 5 geographical or topographical regions in the country. Eretz HaKana'ani v'Halavanon, Ad HaNahar HaGadol Nahar Prat, the land going all the way up to the Euphrates. Re'ei, Natati Lefnechem et Ha'aretz. Go see, God gave us the land. Bo'u Rishu et Ha'aretz, Asher Nishba, Hashem Lavotechem, Li'Avraham, Li'Yitzchak, Li'Yakov, Latet, Lahem, Lazaram, Achrehem. Go to the land. Now Moshe continues. Pasuk Tet. Va'omar Elechem Ba'it Ahi. This is the very next pasuk. Va'omar alechem ba'itahi. So at that same time, I said to you, Lo uchal levadi se'itetchem. I can't handle you all alone. Hashem elokechem hirba'itchem. God has made you numerous. V'inchem hayom kechochvei hashamayim larov. In fact, you are as numerous as the stars in the sky. Hashem elokei avotechem yosef alechem kachem elef pa'amim. And by the way, it's wonderful that you guys have grown so much. Baruch Hashem, that you've increased. You're now a huge nation. You should continue to increase. V'yivarech etchem kasher diber lachem. You should continue. K'nai nahara. You should have lots and lots and lots of more kids. Berecha yisal levadi torchachem u'masachem v'rivchem. I can't do it by myself. And therefore, I've got a great idea. And this continues now in the third box in the bottom. Havu lachem anashim chachamim unevonim viduim leshivtechem. So why don't you find yourselves people who are wise and intelligent and well-known? Vasimim barashechem. I will appoint them as heads, right? And that's all he says. Vata'anu oti, and you responded to me and you said, Vatomru tova davar shadibarta lasot. What a great idea. Va'ekach et rashei shivtechem. So I took the heads of your tribes, anashim chachamim viduim, people who are well known and wise. Va'etenu otam rashim alechem. And I placed them as in leadership positions. Sarei alafim v'sarei miyot, v'sarei chamishim v'sarei asarot. Right, there were those who were, at, you know, a whole hierarchy. Those in charge of tens of thousands, or thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens, the shotrim, and the officers who are going to be in charge of enforcing the law. Va'atzavet shofteichem ba'eita hilemor. And I instructed these shoftim at that point, and I said, Shamoa ben achichem ushvatzetem tzedek, ben ish uvein achiv uvein gero. You should do justice between people, between strangers. Lo takiru panim b'mishpat, kakaton gagadol tishma'un, lo tagru mipnei ish. Again, other ways, do justice, don't show favoritism, don't be afraid of anybody. Kemishpat Elohim hu, because God is the ultimate judge. V'adavar asher yikshem ikem, and anything that's too hard for you, takrivun elai ushmativ. Anything that's too hard, you bring to me. V'atzavet chem ba'itahi et kol advim asher tasun. And I gave you the instructions, all the things that you needed to do. Okay, this is the story that Moshe tells. We know the story, right? The bulk of this story comes from where? Yitro. And whose idea was it? Yitro's idea. Moshe was crumbling under the pressure. And Yitro says, you can't continue like this. I'm going to make a suggestion to you to set up this whole system over here. And when Moshe retells the story, he conveniently forgets to mention his father-in-law. He presents it as his own idea. And once again, very troubling, the humble man taking credit for something that he did not do, taking credit for a good idea. That's the most troubling part of this. There are other parts of this that are also troubling in different kinds of ways. For example, if you go back to the very first paragraph at the top of the page, where Moshe describes God saying it's time to move on. So, actually, God did say it's time to move on. That comes from a different place in Sefer Shemot. And that's the story that's told in Shemot, Perek Lamed Gimel, after the sin of the golden calf. When God says, time to move on, get out of here, I don't want to see you anymore. Moshe takes that instruction, which is clearly an instruction that comes from God's anger with the Jewish people. And the end of that piece is God says, I'm not going with you, and the people go into mourning. And yet Moshe presents this in such a nice, pleasant, oh, you know what? God came to us and said, oh, it's been so nice here at Har Sinai, but you can't stay here forever. It's time to move on to the land. So he takes that conversation and just completely shifts the conversation into something different. The second paragraph does something similar. In the second paragraph, we have where Moshe says, oh, you guys are so numerous. How wonderful that is. And you should continue to be even more numerous. But you know, I'm going to need an assistant rabbi. Or many, many assistants. That language of the numerous, and it's too big for me, that phrase, that comes from someplace else. That's in Parashat Ba'alotcha, Perek Yud Aleph of Sefer Bamidbar Sinai, where Moshe overhears the people crying and they want food. And Moshe says, I can't deal with this anymore. I can't handle these people. This is too much for me. And if you want me to deal with this, kill me. So Moshe goes from kill me because I can't handle them, they're too much of a burden, to Baruch Hashem, it's so wonderful you have large families. So here we have Moshe who's taking the language from at least three different stories, reworks those other ones, and paints this story in a completely different light. And again, most significantly is that he leaves Yitro out of this and takes credit for what is a wonderful idea. Put this together with the first story that we learned, and that leaves us with a very troubling picture. Right? And as you said, This is not the humble Moshe. This is not Moshe the Anav Ma'od. Mikol Ha'adam Asher Al Panei Ha'adama. And now the question is, what do we do with this? So, turns out that, and I wish I could have brought this for you, but the source books were too long, as it was. But when we take the two stories, the story of the judges and the story of the spies, it turns out that they have absolutely nothing to do with one another. You go to the original sources, they're separated by about a year. They have absolutely no connection, not thematically, not in any way whatsoever. But in Moshe's retelling, he does some very interesting things. And I'd like to go through some of these. And I apologize that we don't have all the text in front of you. There was only so much I could put on the pages. I'm going to just share with you some of the language and some of the themes. The first story we have is the story of the judges. And how does it open? And you do have in front of you. The story of the judges. The Lord our God spoke to us at Horeb, saying, "You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Start out and make your way to the hill country of the Amorites and to all their neighbors in the Arava, the hill country, the Shephelah, the Negev, the sea coast, the land of the Canaanites, the Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates. Go! That's the land that I promised to your forefathers. Go take the land." Okay? This sets the framework for the entire chapter. The framework for the chapter is, we are about to begin our final march into the land. That's the story that Moshe is talking about. We're beginning the march to the land, and that's the frame. In the context of that frame, here's what Moshe does. Moshe turns to the people and says, God wants us to go to the land, but you guys have grown tremendously, and I'm going to need some help doing this. So Moshe comes up with the idea. And then, here's the part that you don't have in front of you, and I'll read it to you in the original Hebrew, and I'll give you a translation. And why can't I find... Oh, maybe you do have it here? No, you don't. Yes. You do have it here in Pasuk Yud Dalid. Pasuk 14. Vata'anu oti, you responded to me, Vatomru, and you said, Tov hadavar asher dibarta la'asot. Good idea, Moshe. So the framing over here is, we're about to go conquer the land, and there's an obstacle to us actually, not just conquering, there's an obstacle to us actually being able to set up a Jewish society in the land. And the obstacle is, I'm only one person, and you guys are too many, and that's a good thing. So here's the obstacle. Let me present you with the solution. And your response was that you thought it was a good idea. That's the framing of this story. And what was the result of Moshe's suggestion and Moshe's formulation of a problem, the suggestion to solve the problem, and then the people accepting that? So here's the part that you don't have. So I'll just read this very briefly. Vanisa michorev. So we started traveling. Meaning, we started our journey. We were on the way to the land. I said, I anticipate a problem. I came up with a solution. You agreed to my solution. We implemented the solution. And as a result of implementing my solution, Vanisa mechorev. We started traveling from Chorev. It's exactly how it starts. God says, you've been at Chorev long enough. So guess what? I identified a problem. I suggested a solution. And because we implemented my solution, we were able to travel from Chorev. Vanelechet kol hamidbar hagadol v'hanorahu. And we traveled throughout this entire terrifying desert. The desert that you saw. And we got to the land. We got right there. Va'omar aleichem, and I said to you then, Batem ad har ha'amori, you finally arrived. But you got here. So the way Moshe frames that first story, when we look at the larger frame, is the march to the land has begun. I've identified a problem. I've identified a solution. You liked my solution. We implemented it. And what's the net result out of all that? We got closer to the land. We traveled exactly as God told us, and we got close to the land. Now let me tell you a second story. What's the second story? The second story, the way Moshe rewrites the story, is you identified a problem. You came to me and said, we need to know more about this land. You came up with a solution. Let's send some spies. I agreed to your solution. In fact, you have that language right here on your sheets, on page 4 in the second box, pasuk chaf gimel. Okay, if you're working in the English, it would be on page 6, pasuk 23. Vayitav be'enai hadavar. I thought your solution was okay. It's the same exact language in reverse that Moshe used in the story of the spies. That you thought my idea was good, I agreed to your idea. Vayitav be'enai hadavar. I thought it was a good idea. But guess what? You know what the net result of that story was? I did everything I could to make that story work right. I agreed to your suggestion. We sent the guys. The guys were good guys. They came back with a good report. But you're the ones who messed up. Look what happens when you don't let the leader lead. Look what happens when the people lead the leader. I followed your leadership, and look where it ended up. It ended up where, in the end, you said, oh, we can't do this. You complained. You wanted to turn around. You wanted to go back to Egypt. And in the end, what happened? The very end of that story. And let's see if you have this here. The very end of that story. Yes, you do. Again, at the bottom of page 4 in the on the right-hand side in the fourth box. If you're working in the English, it would be at the top of page 7. And maybe I'm wrong. So hold on. No, not 7. Let's see. No, it's not here. I'm sorry. Wait a second. Yes, the top of page 7 on the left-hand side in the English. The net result of that story is that the people don't go into the land. In fact, the net result of that story, I have it here in the Hebrew. I'm sorry, it's not in the English. In the Hebrew, it's at the very, very bottom of page 5. The very last pasuk mem. V'atem penu lachem. We heard that language of penu. That was the same language that we heard at Mount Sinai. When God said, turn and go to the land. Okay? And it was the same language that Moshe tells at the end of the first story that worked very well. It says, v'nefen v'nisa. We turned and we went. Exactly as God instructed. But look what happens at the end of your story. The one in which I let you lead. V'atem, and you, Penu lachem, this is what God is telling us, Penu lachem, turn, usu'u, but instead of going to the land, hamidbara, go back into the desert. Okay, the same exact language that we saw at the beginning, turn and go into the land, is now being used exactly in the reverse, turn and go away from the land. In which case, what we have here is fascinating. What Moshe has done, he's told two stories, he's completely reshape those stories, but he tells them as a pair. We can only make sense out of them not by looking at all the individual differences between the original and his version, but by looking at the reshaping of those two stories into a pair of stories. And what when you look at the big picture, here's what it comes out. And there are two levels to this. On the first level, Moshe is saying, look, you have to let the leader lead. When the leader leads and the people follow, you get closer to your destination. When the people lead and the leader follows their lead, you get further away from your destination. And that's the first layer of the two stories that Moshe tells. The second layer of those two stories, and we're going to revisit this in just a moment. The second layer is, hey guys, you know, we are standing today on the border of the land. I want to tell you two stories. One is a story that got you very, very close to your goal, and one is a story that got you very far away from the land. You're about to go in. Which of those do you want to happen in the future? And this is the message that Moshe begins delivering in the beginning of the book of Devarim. Now, there were some people here who were troubled by the fact that he omitted Yehoshua in the story of the spies. And this is a good time to talk about Yehoshua. Turns out that when you take a look at the original story of the spies, Yehoshua is an afterthought. The only one who comes to defend the land of Israel is Kalev. It's only after Moshe and Aaron fall on their face, when all hope is lost, that Yehoshua joins Kalev at a later point and says, no, it's okay. But by that point, it's too late. Moshe leaves Yehoshua out of that story completely. And yet, here's the piece that we didn't bring in over here, because we don't have the entire first perek of Devarim. It's a long perek. The piece in the middle that we don't have over here is where Moshe tells them, I'm not going into the land. And he blames it on them, right? Because once again, he wants them to understand what happens when you let the people lead. But Yehoshua will be taking you in. And there's a chunk of three or four psukim that focus almost exclusively on Yehoshua. Yehoshua is not forgotten. Moshe has just chosen exactly where he's going to introduce Yehoshua. Because Moshe is not going into the land. And here he presents to them his successor. Moshe's concern is what happens when he's gone. And he's trying to set up Yehoshua for success. If the people treat Yehoshua the way they treated Moshe, Moshe's afraid as to what the future of this people is going to be like. So he needs to set this up in such a way so that that they begin to understand that they have to give their fullest cooperation to Yehoshua. Now, when you open the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua in the very first perek, it becomes clear that that is a real concern. Right? Sefer Yehoshua starts with the death of Moshe, and you would think that it would focus on Yehoshua, but I think Moshe's name appears more than Yehoshua does. And when Yehoshua turns to the 2.5 tribes, to Reuven, Gad, and the half of Manasseh, and says, you know, you made a deal with Moshe, you better fulfill it, the response is chilling. Well, if God's with you like he was with Moshe, then we'll fulfill it. That's a scary bar to have to meet. It's clear that there's this tension. I can't imagine what it's like being Yehoshua stepping into those shoes. And the people know nothing about this up until 5 weeks before Moshe's death. They think that Moshe is going to continue with them, probably forever. And they have to face the prospect, all of a sudden, of Moshe announcing to them, by the way, I'm not going in, and Yehoshua's taking my place. What do you mean you're not going in? What do you mean you're not continuing with us? Moshe finally, after all that time, earned their trust. And now, he's saying, oh, by the way, Yehoshua's going to finish the job. And a good chunk of Sefer Devarim, especially in the opening and in the closing chapters, is focused on the transition from Moshe to Yoshua. Moshe has to prepare the people to accept his leadership. And this gives us a little bit of an inkling as to what Moshe's agenda in this book is. The agenda is not to make himself look good. It sounds that way when you read each of these stories individually. The agenda is for the people to understand, at least one of the agendas, is for the people to understand that if they're going to be successful in the future, they need to have trust in their leader. They need to let Yahushua lead. And that is one of the primary things that Moshe sets out as his goal in this book. It turns out that connected to that, there's something else. I spend a lot of time with teenage boys and boys who are just past their teenage years. And we talk about a lot of things. And sometimes they call me years later to ask questions. And at some point, as they are ready to, or they think they're ready to enter the adult world, I ask them a question. I say, what stories are you going to tell your children? Have you thought about that? And they look at me. And I say, do you understand the power of the stories that you're going to tell your children? That says what your most core values are. The bedtime stories that you tell them, the things that they hear from you over and over again, that they're going to say, can you tell us that story again? Those stories represent what values are core and what you want to pass on to your children. The stories that we tell, I imagine most of the stories we tell our children are true. Sometimes we embellish the truth because there are values that we want. The historical truth is not important, or certainly not as important as the ethical truth, as the value truth that we want to convey. There are times when people make up stories, and they make up the stories for exactly the same reason. They tell a story because they believe the story conveys some of the deepest values that they have that they want to transmit to their own children. In the research on leadership, so a number of researchers have discovered that one of the things that makes leaders great, leaders, and they're talking about leaders of corporations, but it's true for leaders of people of all kinds, and that is, what is the story that you want to share with the people in your corporation? What's the story that you want to tell to the people in your country? You know, with all the historical revisionism that goes on, and some of it might be true and some of it might not be true, and I'm not one to judge that. So I don't know if all the stories, the negative stories that people tell about the great Zionist leaders and the early Zionist history, I don't know if they're true or they're not true. But here's the interesting thing. What stories have we chosen to tell our children about where we are here today? What are the values that we try to represent in the stories we tell our children and the stories we teach our students? Those values say something very profound, not about the past, but about what kind of country and what kind of society and what kind of culture we want to build. So I think about that, and then I think about Moshe, and I think about Sefer Devarim. Sefer Devarim is the bedtime story that Moshe tells the Jewish people. Sefer Devarim is his last will and testament. It's his ethical will. What does he want to leave the people with? What are the values? The stories that Moshe chooses to tell, and the way in which he chooses to tell those stories, he knows that you and I are going to be able to pick up a chumash and compare them and to see the differences between what happened then. He doesn't think he's pulling a fast one on anybody. And if maybe he thought he could pull a fast one on a story that happened 40 years earlier, he certainly couldn't get away with that with a story that happened 3 weeks earlier. But in choosing to frame the story the way he does and frame the stories the way he does, he's trying to leave behind a legacy that's going to last. Not what happened, but what story do I want you to tell in terms of what happened, not because it serves my personal need for rehabilitation, but because it serves your need to function as a nation. If you're going to live as a nation, you need to learn certain kinds of things. And whether it's learning from the mistakes you made in the past, whether it's learning from the stories we tell about the things that happened in the past, but that is going to help direct the kind of world that that you're going to create for yourselves. And that's what Moshe does. He leaves behind it. It's the book of Devarim is the book of the covenant, and it's a book of multiple covenants, and it's the book of the stories that Moshe wants the people to tell. What are you going to learn from those stories? On the back page, I just brought one quote from two of the leading researchers in leadership, Lee Bowman and Terrence Steele. They're at Harvard. They've been doing a lot of the research in leadership. And they write as follows. Symbolic leaders often embed their vision in a story about us and about our path, present and future. The past, meaning the past that they tell, is usually a golden one, a time of noble purposes and great deeds. The future is the dream, a vision of hope, linked directly to greatness in the past. I'm sure that when they tell the story of their company from the past, they don't tell all the failures. And if they do tell the failures, they tell them in the context of what we can learn from those failures and how we can build on the failures of the past towards the future. The success of such stories is only partially related to their historical validity or empirical support. A story, even a flawed story, will work if it taps into the experience, the values, and the aspirations of the listeners. Sefer Devarim is Moshe's attempt to be that leader for the people, not the leader for that generation, but the leader for future generations, to leave them with a vision for the future and to leave them with a past that they can learn from. Thank you. If there are questions, I'm happy to take questions. That's a great... The question was, I'll repeat it, if you tell your children stories that are not connected to reality and they're going to find out, won't that work against you in the long run? I believe the answer is absolutely yes. It will work against you in the long run unless you're the one who introduces to them that the story that you told is not 100% true. I mean, when they're young, it's an interesting thing. Young children... And there's a lot of psychological research that goes into this. Young children live lives that need to be these binary lives. There are good and there's bad, right? That black and white, and the good guys are the white and the bad guys are the black. And they need that. They live with their superheroes. My mommy is the most beautiful and the best cook, and my daddy is the strongest. And right, and whatever all the stereotypes are, and you listen to any 4-year-old, and they need that in order to survive. If they don't have that when they're 4, then they don't have an anchor for later on in life. But if they have that when they're 14, then there's a serious problem. By 14, they should be questioning who their parents are, and they should be, if they don't know their parents' flaws already, their parents should be sharing those with them so that they can learn from that too. The answer is absolutely yes. So Moshe is doing this. He knows full well that he's going to be discovered. That doesn't make a difference. He will be discovered. He wrote the book in which it's being discovered. And yet at the same time, when he talks to these people, he needs to leave them with a vision of the future and with an understanding of the past. regardless of whether it's absolutely true or not, it has to guide them towards their future. And they'll figure out, just like you and I, we were able to figure out that his version of the story is not perfect. And he knows that it's not perfect, and he knows that we know that it's not perfect. And yet still it's important to leave people with that, so that they walk away with a message that's going to lead them into the future. So I'm going to tell you a story that I heard from a great conductor. There's an Israeli conductor called Itai Talgam, who's a fascinating man. He does workshops on leadership, and because he's a conductor of an orchestra, he does his workshops based on film clips of conductors, and he shows you different conductors and different conducting styles. One of the conductors that he loves to present is Leonard Bernstein. He tells a story that Leonard Bernstein was had a very interesting mode of conducting. And he was once invited to lead the Berlin Philharmonic. I think the Berlin Philharmonic. And they were used to having a good Yecky as their conductor, whom like this, and when he went like this, you had to hit your note exactly when, and you had to follow every movement. And Bernstein shows up, and he goes like this. And after about 15 or 20 seconds of that, one of the violin players, I think, said, "Maestro, when do you want us to start?" And he said, "When you can't stand it anymore." I love that story for a lot of reasons. And I think the same is true when it comes to when to break the simplistic molds of our children. When you can't stand the fact that they walk around with these simplistic ideas anymore, when you know that they can't stand walking around the simplistic ideas anymore, then you have to be the one to introduce that complexity to them. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.